The British Prime Minister has hailed his government's vaccination program as a success. The question now is whether that parliamentary committee put Boris Johnson's security of tenure ahead of his responsibility for allowing the COVID-19 outbreak to soar in communities across the UK in the spring and summer of last year. Saeed Puriza, London.
Public outpouring against Israel in Pakistan. The streets of the mega city of Karachi flooded with protesters in solidarity with Palestinians. There is no let-up to anti-Israel protest in this 220 million populated Muslim country after Israel attacked and desecrated Islam's third holiest site in the eastern Jerusalem Al-Quds and imposed a unilateral war on Gaza. The huge collateral and human losses in the latest round of one-sided war imposed on unarmed Palestinians has once again become a rallying point to unify people from all segments of the society in Pakistan to join hands to protest against Israel.
We thank to Allah. Today people in every Muslim country stand by Palestinians. And by God willing, we would continue our war against Israel until we liberate Al-Quds Mosque.
The anti-Israel protests have been swelling in Pakistan despite a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas administration in Gaza. Pakistan's government is feeling the heat of public pressure, which is reflected in country's foreign minister's rare and blunt remarks about Western media outlets on how they have been whitewashing war crimes of Israel against Palestinians.
Israel is losing out. They're losing the media war despite their connections. They are losing the media war. The tide is turning.
What are their connections?
Deep pockets.
What does that mean?
Well, they're very influential people. I mean, they control media.
I would call that an anti-Semitic remark.
Pakistan has rejected criticism of pro-Israeli lobbies and Western media, claiming that country's foreign minister's remarks were anti-Semitic. On the contrary, foreign minister's analogy about nexus between Israel and Western media has been welcomed across the Muslim world. Islamabad says the Western media has been covering up the massacre of Palestinians by propagating it as Israel's right of self-defense. On the other hand, whenever leaders of the Muslim countries speak truth about Israel's aggression and apartheid state's overgrown influence on Western media to whitewash its war crimes, they call it anti-Semitic. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Bishop Talbot Swan, a highly respected civil rights activist, expressed a sympathy and solidarity among the African-American community for the Palestinians as outrage over Israel's actions has continued to grow.
If any people should resonate with what's going on in Palestine, it's black people in America. Even when we look at what's happening on the streets in our nation, many police departments across America actually go to Israel to be trained by the military in so-called counterterrorism strategies. And then they come here into black communities and employ those strategies on black citizens. So we fully understand their struggle. It resonates with us. And we stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
For many, the fact the U.S. government funds Israel while reparations owed to black Americans have yet to be paid is hypocritical.
They can find nearly $4 billion a year to give to Israel, but they can't find any money to give to African Americans who descended from enslaved Africans. It's a travesty. It's a shame. And we're not asking for a handout. We're not asking for you to do us a favor. That's money that is owed. That's a debt that the United States has yet to pay.
Like many faith leaders, Bishop Swan reiterated his continued support for the Palestinians in the face of racist apartheid.
Oppressed people all over the world are watching what's happening. We are standing in solidarity with you. We are pushing and pressing for governmental structures to condemn the violence, to stop the funding of terrorism, because that's exactly what it is. And we want them to remain steadfast, to be strong, and to know that we are behind them.
The demands for the U.S. to stop funding Palestinian oppression and to implement justice for Black America will continue as long as the status quo remains in place.
Support for the Palestinians has undoubtedly intensified, with millions of people around the world condemning Israel, demanding an end to the occupation of Palestine. Richard Sudam, London.
With less than a month to go until the presidential election in Iran, people are discussing about the policies the next president must follow to solve the problems. Out of over 400 contenders, about 40 heavyweight ones claim their number one goal is to solve economic problems that have been growing during the past years. In order to see how these plans are feasible, we talked to some lawmakers regarding the objectives every hopeful must have in mind.
In every election, the economy is of great significance to people, especially at a time they've experienced tough times in the face of economic issues. Hopefuls make promises, but people must be watchful not to pin hope on their slogans. Their slogans must have a logical basis. In my opinion, what the country needs in terms of economy is a look at international capabilities. Of course, the sanctions are biting, but we can't say all our economic problems are because of the sanctions. Most of our economic issues are the result of not paying attention to domestic capabilities.
Another lawmaker told us the most important things a president must follow are transparency and accountability.
People expect the runners to be honest with them. They say the next president must have a comprehensive plan for the economic issues. It means the result of their plans must be seen in the economic basket of the families. Within the past 8 years, the government was waiting for decisions to be made outside the country. The next president should fight against corruption and injustice.
The MPs stressed that having good relations with the world for economic improvement is a must, but each country should rely on its own capabilities.
The livelihood of people and solving economic problems is the main slogan of most of the hopefuls for the 13th presidential election of Iran. They also say that they have detailed plans to improve the life quality of people. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Outrage against the Zionist regime's ongoing apartheid system and routine attacks on Palestinian rights and lives is mounting worldwide, setting the stage for a new burst of energy in the global movement for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions, BDS, against the Israeli regime, a nonviolent movement in support of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and equality. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Marjorie Khan, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Outrage over Zionist regime's human rights violations is fueling global BDS movement. Stay tuned for more.
Thank you.
The Zionist regime police are now threatening to carry out mass arrests against Palestinian citizens of occupied territories. Arrests intended to punish those who took part in sit-ins and other protests in solidarity with Palestinians living in East Al-Quds and Gaza. This latest attack on Palestinian rights comes just days after Zionist regime police once again attacked Palestinians at Al-Aqsa Mosque and after the Zionist regime military viciously bombed Gaza for 11 days, killing 248 Palestinians and wounded more than 1,900, destroying 16,800 Palestinian homes and displacing tens of thousands of Palestinians. Outrage against the Zionist regime's ongoing apartheid system and routine attacks on Palestinian rights and lives is mounting worldwide, setting the stage for a new burst of energy in the global movement for boycotts, divestment, and sanctions BDS against the Zionist regime, a non-violent movement in support of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and equality. Renewed calls for BDS have emerged in the reshaped new political moment following the ceasefire that began on May 20th, after President Joe Biden, who has essentially continued Donald Trump's policy of pandering to the Zionist regime, finally put his foot down following outrage by a critical mass of congressional Democrats and protests in the U.S. and around the world, and said he expected significant de-escalation of Israel's attacks on Palestinians. In the occupied territories, the Zionist regime regulates the entries and departures of Palestinians and controls of the borders, airspace, shoreline, and waters off the Gaza coast. The Zionist regime expels Palestinians from their homes and facilitates illegal Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. Palestinians are forced to live in constant uncertainty, making it difficult to perform simple tasks and make plans, according to B'Tselem, the leading Israeli human rights organization. The BDS movement is largely modeled on the boycott that helped end apartheid in South Africa. As has been confirmed most recently by Human Rights Watch, the Zionist regime also maintains a system of apartheid. In 2001, the National Lawyers Guild sent a delegation to the region and published a report that documented the system of apartheid in occupied Palestine. It detailed illegal Jewish settlements and bypass roads, the restricted movement of Palestinians, discriminatory land policies, the differential treatment of Jews and Palestinian non-Jews, and the Zionist regime policing of Palestinians' political expression. It analyzed the indiscriminate and excessive use of lethal force against Palestinians and their property, delays and prevention of medical treatment, and the Zionist regime's collective punishment of the Palestinians. Boycotts involve the withdrawal of support for the Zionist regime and Zionist and international companies that are violating Palestinian human rights, including Israeli regime academic, cultural, and sporting institutions. Divestment companies ask churches, universities, banks, pension funds, and local councils to withdraw their investments from all Israeli and international companies complicit in the violation of Palestinian rights. Sanctions campaigns pressure governments to cease military trade and free trade agreements and urge them to expel Israeli regime from international fora. BDS has had a significant impact on the Zionist regime. The BDS campaign played a major role in the 46% decrease in foreign direct investment in the Zionist regime in 2014, according to the UN Conference on Trade and Development. In a 2018 poll, 40% of Americans overall and 56% of Democrats supported the imposition of sanctions or even more serious penalties on the Zionist regime to end the occupation. Boycotts constitute protected freedom of speech, assembly, and association under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. They have long been used to fight injustice and achieve social change. The U.S. Supreme Court has held that speech on public issues occupies the highest rung of the hierarchy of First Amendment values and is entitled to special protection. The High Court ruled that advocating and supporting boycotts to bring about political, social, and economic change, like boycotting the Israeli regime, are unquestionably protected by the First Amendment. Biden is staunchly against the BDS movement. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said at his confirmation hearing that both he and Biden resolutely opposed BDS. Linda Thomas Greenfield, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, vehemently denounced BDS at her confirmation hearing, as did Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen in written answers to questions from senators before her hearing. The success of the BDS movement has motivated the Zionist regime apologists to sponsor anti-boycott legislation on the state, local, and federal levels. These forces include right-wing Christian Zionist organizations and other Israeli lobby groups often funded by the Israeli regime. 31 states have anti-BDS legislation in effect since 2014. 219 anti-boycott bills have been introduced, but only 50 of them have been passed, thanks to strong opposition by grassroots and civil liberties groups. The anti-boycott laws vary in how they define boycotts and the scope of the boycotts at which they are directed. Some bills target boycotts of the Zionist regime or goods and services from this regime, and others aimed at boycotts of allied countries. The legislation often punishes boycotts of territories controlled by the Zionist regime, reaching boycotts of services or products from or to unlawful Israeli settlements. Many bills threaten criminal penalties and economic sanctions. This legislation also has a broader intent to chill and intimidate activists and their would-be supporters into believing that BDS is not illegal, Palestine legal website says. Some legislation, like the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, which was introduced in Congress in 2017 and again in 2019, would have gone even further with criminal penalties and jail for furnishing information in support of a boycott of the Israeli regime. The act was defeated in January 2021. The world watched horrified as the Zionist regime forces once again slaughtered Palestinians in Gaza, which is often called the world's largest open-air prison, one of the most densely populated areas on Earth, containing more than 5,000 inhabitants per square kilometer until they agreed on a ceasefire. This latest violence has galvanized even more people in the United States and around the world to stop the Zionist regime's brutality against the Palestinians. In this moment of mass outrage, as more people join the BDS movement and work together to overcome the strategies of repression and criminalization aimed to thwart it, BDS movement has the potential to grow and become an even more powerful force in the Palestinian struggle to end the Zionist regime's occupation and system of apartheid. 10 minutes.
Saudi Arabia, one of the major belligerents in the all-out war against Yemen. Armed to the teeth with state-of-the-art weapons, Saudi top brass were under the impression that they would win the war easily. Their miscalculation, however, has resulted in a war of attrition, which has caused a loss of morale within the army. The Saudis are now faced with the double whammy of the Yemeni Ansarullah movement gaining ground steadily since the breakout of the war, and the increasing number of low-spirited forces who are sick and tired of a meaningless war. Saudi Leaks has recently published a report revealing a wave of executions of Saudi soldiers. According to the whistleblowing website, the Saudis recently sentenced to death a number of soldiers who had refused to fight in the Yemen war. Yet such barbaric measures have not helped the Saudi soldiers restore their morale in the battlefield.
So we're seeing a lot of defections in the Saudi army, but more interestingly than that, there are actually a lot of defections into the Ansar Allah that have happened from the Saudi army. When there have been captures, you know, in Yemen by the Saudi mercenaries, a lot of them, you know, more drawn to the cause of the Ansar Allah, more even drawn to their humanity and approach in treating captives and soldiers, they've actually been defecting over. So the Saudi army, just like the Zionist occupying army, it's facing a huge crisis of morale from its own soldiers. There is really nothing that is, there's no cause or no reason that's really keeping them together.
Meanwhile, the Saudi opposition National Assembly Party has warned of new round of executions, pointing out, with all these heavy losses, and in light of the continuation of this war and its mistakes and risks, we were surprised by the Saudi authorities by announcing the execution of the three soldiers.
The Saudi army doesn't even really know how to fight. A lot of their weapons capabilities and their capabilities during the siege have just been imported or bought off. So there isn't really a cohesive Saudi army to begin with as far as the fighting force. But what we're seeing now is coming into collapse. Lots of defections, as I mentioned. And so, obviously, like with the recent executions, it's showing that this is like a major threat of what's left of the Saudi army.
Made up of Saudi dissidents living in exile, the National Assembly Party says the executions were carried out in complete ambiguity and absence of fair trials. These soldiers are convicted on high treason charges. Breaking down the charges, Saudi Leak writes, these soldiers have refused to take part in the war, to bomb Yemeni civilians, to destruct Yemeni infrastructure, or to carry out the scorched earth policy in Yemen, which is pursued from time to time.
The economic losses that the Saudi regime has incurred, it's also affected their army, which is weak. It doesn't know how to fight. It doesn't know how to, it doesn't have anything to fight for, really. So I'm definitely not surprised that the morale has gone the same way that the American occupying army has in Iraq, at the end of the Iraq War, or that the Zionist army is finding themselves in right now. any unjust war fought is going to have that effect on the occupying army that is fighting it and causing atrocities.
Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is under fire for his rash decision to declare war against neighboring Yemen in a failed bid to establish his foothold in the region as a rising star in the political sphere of the region.
Well, definitely the Saudi army has been faced a crushing defeat from the Yemeni resistance, and the Saudi army was never really a army that knew how to fight to begin with. We saw in Yemen there were huge numbers of mercenaries just imported from Sudan, imported from, you know, other poor countries in the world. And essentially you can't really build an army just by buying them off. Saudis have never had to really defend their territory. They've always just been a fake like comprador nation that has been bought off and built off their ability to be bought off too.
In addition to the war itself, there have been a number of other things that have affected the situation. One of them having to do with the kingdom's deteriorating economy. The Saudi forces are complaining about low salaries, poor health services, slashed bonuses, and widespread administrative corruption in the Saudi military, to say the least. To top it all, these soldiers cannot freely express their concerns, as they know any objection might cost them dearly.
Well, the losses that have been inflicted by the resistance onto the Saudi army have also definitely been great enough to, you know, impact them considerably. Saudi Arabia has had its, oil and gas production facilities hit and targeted by the resistance successfully. So the economic losses that have both gone the Middle East in this war, as well as the failure of the weapons defense systems that Saudi Arabia has invested huge amounts of money in, as well as the losses incurred by losing militarily, have definitely had their toll on the regime's ability to pay off its mercenaries.
The Saudis are experiencing one humiliating defeat after another. They have proven to be too incompetent to win a war, even against the poorest country in the region. At the same time, they have been too vulnerable against the counterattacks mounted by the Ansarullah movement, all despite being one of the world's largest military spenders. It's a reminder that military superiority is no guarantee for military success.
We see all the weapons and all the money in the world cannot build an army, essentially. The Saudis have never been able to fight on their own. They've never been able to fight, period. And especially during this siege, everything, as I've mentioned, has just been imported and bought off on the part of the Saudi army. None of it actually comes to its own merits or capabilities in warfare and in battle, which are none, which are non-existent. And it's the same thing with the Zionist entity, too. The same exact story. And with the United States. No army as far as a force of people that actually fight or have something to fight for, essentially. Just weapons, technology that are futile against popular forces.
The fact is, the Saudi military is simply too large, but inadequately organized, and with the personnel who have received insufficient training. Moreover, there are a lot of tribal factions within the Saudi military, which have created an atmosphere of mistrust in the establishment. There are reports of growing discontent with the Saudi military or with the mismanagement of the war by King Salman and his son. Whereas the Saudi airstrike campaign has proven to be largely unsuccessful, the Saudis have not been able to accomplish any of their stated goals on the ground. 6 years into the Yemen war, Riyadh has yet to figure out how to send its forces into the battlefield against one of the most deprived fighters in the world.
How does it happen? مهم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight.
Globally, there's been an encouraging downturn in new coronavirus cases in May of 2021, but cases are still at a very high level overall, with worldwide statistics masking huge differences across countries and areas. Stay with us for an article concerning this issue written by Michael Head, Senior Research Fellow in Global Health at University of Southampton in England. The piece is titled, The Nations Most Likely to See Next Big COVID Spikes. The piece has been taken from The Conversation website. Beneath COVID-19 complexities, there is a simple hypothesis. If the coronavirus is introduced into a susceptible population and those people are able to mix, there will be significant community transmission. We have seen this happen around the world, including in India recently. Could we see similar situations with cases rapidly spiking and health systems being overwhelmed? Well, the short answer is yes. Globally, there's been an encouraging downturn in new cases in May of 2021, but cases are still at a very high level overall, with worldwide statistics masking huge differences across countries and areas. The global vaccine rollout is also progressing slowly, with most of the world still susceptible to COVID-19. These factors mean there's potential for further spikes like those seen in India. We only need look to Nepal to see a similar situation unfolding there. Other countries have rising caseloads too, with many eyes looking nervously at Latin America, Southeast Asia, and some of the smaller island nations. Our World in Data website highlights Laos, Timor, Thailand, Cambodia, Fiji, and Mongolia as countries where numbers have recently doubled in the shortest period, from 16 to 23 days for these countries. For comparison, the doubling rate for India ahead of its second wave was 43 days. When looking at countries where reported deaths are doubling most quickly, it's Timor, Thailand, Mongolia, Cambodia, and Uruguay. They range from 4 days to 31 days. For countries such as Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam, highly praised so far, the problem is their high susceptibility. They've had few cases in the past, so there is little natural immunity in those countries, and they're now experiencing outbreaks amid an inability to procure a large vaccine supply. Vaccine coverage, therefore, is low. Thailand and Vietnam have given a first vaccine dose to only 2% and 1% of their populations, respectively. Elsewhere, it's the mixing part of the equation that's more of a concern. For example, Japan is soon to host the Olympics, attracting athletes, dignitaries, coaches, and media from every corner of the globe. Despite a ramping up of vaccine distribution over the past month, the program has been sluggish, with less than 4% of the population having received a first dose of the vaccine. In this author's view, the Olympics should not go ahead this year in Japan. Latin America continues to experience a huge burden of COVID-19 and so is also at risk. Argentina, Uruguay, Costa Rica, and Colombia are all still in the top 10 countries in terms of daily new confirmed cases per million people. On the other hand, sub-Saharan Africa has, on the face of it, with some exceptions, handled the pandemic relatively well, with countries praised for an early and decisive response, having learned lessons from the West Africa Ebola outbreak of 2013 and 2016. Of course, our conclusions must be cautious. Creating high-quality real-time data during a public health emergency is complicated, and data is patchy and slow in most parts of the world. For instance, the extent of transmission in refugee camps and in conflict settings is very much unknown. Some vulnerable areas may slip under the radar. The reporting of data may also be influenced by local politics. Some countries, such as Tanzania, have chosen to downplay the severity of the COVID-19 pandemic. The former Tanzanian president, John Magufuli, died in March of 2021, and news coverage suggested he may have died of COVID-19 amid reports of uncontrolled outbreaks around the country and sharp increases in deaths. However, officially, the impact of COVID-19 in Tanzania has been low. Similarly, Belarus is reporting low death rates, 27.8 per 100,000 population, having refused to consider COVID-19 as a serious threat. But the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation has modeled the country's actual death rate to be one of the highest in the world, at 472.2 per 100,000 people. The timing of elections and volatility of political governance may be interesting factors to observe when trying to predict future spikes. Political mass gatherings in India are likely to have contributed to the extensive recent transmission of the coronavirus. The Prime Minister and Health Minister of India encouraged people to attend these political rallies, wrongly believing earlier in the spring that India had reached the end stages of the pandemic. Elsewhere, former US President Donald Trump's campaigning events caused numerous super-spreading events in the United States. While in Myanmar, there were reported breaches of COVID-19 protocols due to electioneering and mass gatherings. Myanmar's elections in October of 2020 were preceded by the highest spike in cases the country had experienced. Soon after the election, stricter policies were put in place and case rates lowered. Countries that engage in similar behavior, or like India, declare success too early, could well be the next hotspots. Of course, the next outbreak may prove difficult to spot. Few of us could easily point to Timor on a map. This lack of knowledge influences our perception over local situations and also the news coverage that countries get. Compare Nepal and Timor to Brazil and India, on which public reporting has been extensive. Plus, some countries might not be reporting good quality data, may have much bigger burdens of COVID-19 than appears to be the case. The next big outbreak will be reliant on a perfect storm of a few variables coming together. At the core of this storm will be a slow vaccine rollout and susceptible populations mixing freely. Political rallies, large-scale festivals and protests are examples of mass gatherings that can seed new outbreaks of the coronavirus and facilitate sufficient spread to rapidly overwhelm a healthcare system. But depending on where this happens, we may not even notice.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing A Revolution in Four Seasons, directed by Jesse Buter. And joining me in the studio, we have Carol Allen, who writes for CloseUpFilm.com, Movies One, and is an editor and film critic for AEA Digest. And beside her is Catherine Shakhdam, who is a political analyst and director of the Shakhbakhner Institute of Middle Eastern Studies. Now, A Revolution in Four Seasons tells the story of two women with opposing political views fighting for different futures in Tunisia, the country that sparked the Arab Spring. Though, as this documentary shows, there are many unexpected challenges that lay ahead in trying to fight for a better future for your country.
We can little by little show the drawbacks of drinking alcohol, the drawbacks of wearing the bikini.
I was the first person from this village to be elected in the parliament.
Our people are waiting us to start writing the constitution.
They wrote one article of the constitution.
There is a change since the revolution. Now the Tunisian society is divided.
I could have been in the United States, but you put me in Tunisia because you have this crazy idea that this country can be a democracy.
And welcome both of you to the show. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on. And so this documentary takes you on a journey into the lives of two very different Tunisian women, and who both embrace the revolution but have completely different visions for the future of their country. Carol, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on A Revolution in Four Seasons?
Well, it's interesting and important to see the world of two women from a very different country, as I said, very different point of view, with whom we have more in common than we might think. I don't want to go too far ahead, but at one point, for example, both of them get married, they have their first babies, they both have to cope with a problem which is universal for women throughout the world. How do you have your place in the world and still fulfill your duties as a wife and mother? And interestingly, it is Jawara, the more conventionally Muslim lady, who solves it most easily in that she is involved in politics. She's a member of the Constituent Assembly, which is writing the Constitution, sorry. And her husband, he helps her a lot. The other woman, Emna,
She's a secularist in the film.
She is a secularist. Well, she is a Muslim, I think, in that she observes the fasting rules, but she doesn't wear the hijab. Yes.
Which is she wants to see a difference between religion and the rule of the country.
Yes, she wants a more she wants, as it says in the trailer, a state which is like Sweden or France, whereas the other lady is a member of the Islamic Democratic Party, and she wants an Islamic state which is still democratic. Which is a concept we in the West probably find quite difficult, because we tend to think Islamic, and we're very wary of it. So it was a very positive film from that point of view.
And quite refreshing to see that.
Yeah, Jawara, she really impressed me. I thought she was she's a lovely, intelligent, thoughtful woman. She's not a scary Islamist at all. I'd like her to be my friend.
Catherine, I'd like to bring you in here. What was your take on the documentary?
I found it very interesting. I mean, to be fair with you, I didn't expect that I would actually enjoy it, because, you know, I thought it was going to be one of those, you know, movie on the so-called Arab Spring. But what I found particularly interesting is that you have those two women who, you know, at the beginning of the documentary, you expect to be kind of, you know, on the opposite side of the river, I would say. They're actually quite similar in their hope for Tunisia, which is essentially to empower the people and have a system that represents, you know, the people but doesn't betray, you know, their identity. And I think that, you know, the issue here is really identity, is how does, you know, an Islamic or self-identified Islamic country find itself, you know, not just within the region, but within, you know, I would say, you know, this desire to be democratic and this desire to function, you know, within the international community.
It is an interesting point that this documentary raises, that democracy is different for different people.
Exactly.
And has different interpretations.
I think for me that was the core issue, that, you know, it's maybe not talked about, but it's there, where, you know, you have, you know, someone who wants to have a secular democracy, you know, like France, where, you know, the state and religion are quite separate, which is fine. And then, you know, you have the other point of view where she talks about you know, identity, how not to betray your heritage, your tradition. I think this is something that hasn't been talked about, this necessity for the Islamic world to actually have a democracy that looks like them, rather than looks like a Western democracy. We need to understand that there are more than just one way to be democratic. I don't think they're that different. I think they're very different in their approach to democracy or how they would like to formulate it. But they come across the same issues, where, you know, secularism is really good on paper to some extent, but then there's issue attached to that. And then the same thing when it comes to Islamism, where, you know, there was a lot of issue. I mean, when you talk about terrorism, for example, or how there was this...
Actually, we're going to touch that on that a bit later on.
When you think that in order for me to be a progressive, I have to look like the Western people, to eat like them, to think like them, to have the same taste, this harms not only our identity, but the human identity itself. You cannot be just a subordinate to France or to the United States and forget about your religion, forget about your history, forget about your language, even your language, in order to be just to be progressive, I think.
Carol, you mentioned a bit earlier how you were surprised to see, as a Westerner, a Muslim woman, a strong Muslim woman, getting involved in politics. And she also has a strong family life, and her husband stays at home. What was this like watching this for you?
Well, as I said earlier, it was a bit of an eye-opener. I mean, that particular point you raised there about the political woman who is well supported by her Islamic, her Muslim husband, whereas the French-speaking woman who wants to be who wants to be like Sweden or France, her husband, who has spent a lot of time in America, behaves pretty much like a Western bloke. He goes into politics and leaves her at home holding the baby, you know, with her life on hold.
And you can see their relationship became strained, whereas yes, the others didn't.
Yes. I mean, it is actually very good PR for the idea of an Islamic state which is not repressive and which can be democratic. In fact, the clip we just saw was reiterating the points that Catherine just made.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine, what do you think? Do you think this documentary shows the positive side of Muslims?
Well, it shows definitely that, first of all, number one, there is a space for women in politics and Islam. So this is not, you know, the two don't have to clash. And, you know, this idea that, for example, that women should not enter politics, I think is linked to, you know, Wahhabism, Salafism, radical Islam, basically, where it's Islam is being deconceptualized. It's taken away from its context, and it doesn't mean anything anymore. But what you see here is very interesting because she's, you know, she's hammering on the idea of identity. And again, I think that it's, you know, we need to listen to what she's saying because it's just, you know, it's a neo-colonial reaction, I would say, where, you know, whether she's right or wrong, there is this idea that the West is trying to impose a certain socio-political model, and there's a reaction against it because people want to find their own way through democracy. And I think that if we want to have a real discussion on how we move forward in the Middle East, how we could enable and accompany those countries to actually find, you know, their way and be democratic, we have to make sure that we don't impose any particular model. And, you know, if you look at Iran, for example, which is I know that people will say, no, it's not, but it is a very progressive society. I think it's a perfect example of that, where it doesn't feel the constraint of colonialism. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be to identify itself against it. And I think that's what you see in Tunisia, is that Tunisia was, you know, recently, I mean, historically speaking, recently freed or independent from France. And yet you see how France is very much, you know, impacting the way that they think themselves forward in politics. And, you know, I think that the Islamists tapped into it, reacted against it, and somehow, I would say, you know, played it to their advantage. So it was a very good PR stunt, as you mentioned. But, of course, you know, some of them were genuine, some of them less so. And so, you know, we saw the abuses that it led to. But, again, I'm going to say that, for example, it took France 5 republics, 2 empires, and it fell monarchy to, you know, to finally be a democracy. So I think we need to give it time. You know, we need to understand that you don't become a democratic state.
I think, yeah, we're going to discuss more the future and the problems of the country that it faced.
The goal is to train community organizers. We believe that it's very important to have independent representatives in the Constituent Assembly elections. We're doing it Obama style, actually, here, you know, grassroots movement.
So I'd like to talk about the secularist movement in the documentary. It was Emna who was supporting a secular country for Tunisia. And Carol, what are some of the struggles that she faced in the pursuit of power?
Some of the struggles that she faces? Her chief campaign seems to be, her chief issue seems to be with the police, who don't appear to be democratic at all. And this is, you know, this is something which is not just a problem in Tunisia. The personal issues I mentioned earlier about coping with being a person, an effective person in the outside world, and with her baby. I actually found her, I have to admit, a less interesting character than Jawahara.
Really?
But what is interesting as well, I knew very little about the history of Tunisia, really, until the Arab Spring happened. Again, an eye-opener for Westerners is we tend to think an Islamic state is going to be repressive, a secular state isn't. Well, in this instance, the dictator Ben Ali, was it?
Yeah.
He was a secularist. And when we come to the elections, the fear is that the secular party is going to bring back another dictator. So the points that Catherine was making earlier about not imposing our view, our Western view of democracy, on other countries is very important because we do tend to think, well, we've got it right. And you know, we, in the case of Britain, we had an empire, we had colonies, we know how to run things. And you actually have to respect what is there. It's quite natural for human beings to want more independence, to want a more democratic state. But I think they have to find their own way of doing it. And it rather looks like Tunisia is doing this now.
Do you think it's in a better state now? I mean, do you get a sense from the documentary that before the revolution it was in a bad state?
I get the sense from the documentary. I'm not always clear from the documentary what exactly was going on in Tunisia before. For example, Johara refers to the fact that women have had the vote for a long time. Then we get a caption with the first lot of elections in the documentary. This is the first time there have been free elections ever in this country. I know, can you explain that?
Yes, I was going to ask Catherine, well, actually. Could you give us
well, women were given, you know, the right to vote. I can't remember when. It was quite early on. I think it was the 1950s or something, you know, because of France. And then, you know, when Tunisia became independent, it kind of carried on. And as you mentioned, Ben Ali was very, I would say, you know, secular, very progressive, at least, you know, by France's standards. And which is why he was, you know, quite well liked by the French government. There's a difference in between, you know, where all people can vote and they actually have a right to say something. And I think this is the problem here, is that it's not because you live in a secular, you know, republic, for example, that you actually have a say in anything. And I think that's what they refer to. The sad thing is that I get the sense that, you know, somehow both of them felt that their revolution, you know, the way that they imagined themselves to become free, was taken away from them, you know, for different reasons. So, you know, secularism didn't happen the way Emna wanted. And then, you know, for the other lady, it's, you know, she felt, I think, betrayed by this move towards, you know, radicalism, where there was an imposition of certain views, where she hoped that it was more an invitation to. And I think this is the main problem here.
And I wanted to mention another part in the documentary, where Johara gave a powerful speech in Parliament talking about how they have to smash the terrorist stereotypes and work together. What did you make of that scene?
Well, I admired the power of her speech. That wasn't the scene that made the biggest impression on me, though. One that did, which is, again, very important to the image of Islam in the West, was at the end, towards the end, because terrorism isn't mentioned very much in the film, although I understand it is a problem that there was...
Both facing the Muslims and the secularists.
Yeah, I mean...
Isn't just the Muslim problem?
Indeed. But there is a terrorist incident towards the end of the film, and Juara says, this is awful, this is not what my father taught me, this is not what is in the Quran, we must fight it.
Terrorism is in the heart of the capital. It's in Bardo. It's in the museum, next to the parliament, and especially I was there as a deputy, and I was there as an ordinary citizen. This is not the Islam I belong to. This is not the Islam that my father teaches me, and this is not the Islam that I read in the Quran. I can't read any verse in the Quran that justifying what they are doing now. It's a religion which preaches tolerance, which preaches peace. We have to fight them.
That was a really moving moment in the documentary, that fight for struggle. I mean, you get the sense that the revolution was in fact the easy part, and the problem lies in rebuilding the country. Is that the impression you got also?
Yes, and isn't that always the problem with revolutions? You know, it's all very well to tear something down, but then you have to find the right way of building something up. And another point that lady made earlier in the film was the difficulty of reconciling being an idealist with being a politician. And that, again, is another universal point that she's making there.
And yeah, it's a very human story that this documentary tells also. And so 6 years on, Catherine, from the Arab Spring, what problems still persist in the country? So briefly there was an issue of terrorism. Yeah.
Well, I think Tunisia, interestingly enough, I mean, started it off. And it's a blueprint, but, you know, it's a compounding of everything, all the issues